The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening and welcome. I'm Toby Dichter, daughter of Melia Gordon, and a proud director of the Free Library Foundation. What does the foundation do? Right. It enables programming the city can't afford, like tonight, and after-school programs and civic engagement. At this time of discourse, in our branches, because of the Sutherland's generous funding, neighbors attend neighborhood meetings about subjects that they're interested in, hot topics, and then it's moderated from somebody from WHYY. So it's civil dialogue, and we enable that. Please consider giving to the Free Library Fund. It's a wonderful return on investment because libraries are indeed the last bastion of democracy. Tonight's guest cares deeply about democracy. It's in his Greek heritage. This man who taught us to pronounce all five syllables of his name and did so with pride. I've always wondered, who is this unusual fellow? George Stephanopoulos' father is the Greek Orthodox priest and Dean Emeritus of the Greek Orthodox Church in New York City. And his mother for years was the director of the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of the American National News Service. So he comes by it honestly, but what accounts for his impressive rise in journalism? I think it's because he's super smart and works crazy hard. With a degree in political science, summa cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa from Columbia, where he cut his teeth as a sports broadcaster for the university's radio station, to Rhodes Scholar, who studied both political science and theology at Oxford. He worked his way from aide to chief of staff for Democratic Congressman Ed Fagan of Ohio and went on to work for Michael Dukakis, another Greek American. That led to work for Dick Gephardt, House Majority Leader, and eventually to his becoming senior advisor to President Bill Clinton. After leaving the White House at the end of Clinton's first term, he became a political analyst for ABC News and rose steadily from there. Okay, but what accounts for the smile? Perhaps it's being married for 23 years to someone who makes him laugh. Actress, author, comedian Allie Wentworth, and having two daughters. Or maybe it's just getting up at 3 o'clock every morning. But why this book and why now? I loved his first book where he bared his soul in All Too Human, but that was in 1999. So why The Situation Room? As you read this book, you'll understand it's all about the subtitle. The inside story of presidents in crisis. We're taken through the angst, the process, and the fascinating drama that happened in the sit room from each administration. I look around and I think every one of us in this room will love the play-by-play of the crises we witnessed in our lifetime. So let's turn the table and have our own Tamala Edwards of 6ABC Action News Morning Edition, who's terrific, interview the consummate interviewer. Join me in welcoming host of This Week, co-host of Good Morning America, and all-round lovely man, George Stephanopoulos.
Thank you.
Good evening, good evening, good evening. Thank you for coming out. You know this is like a second home to me. I love this library. I love this room. George and I have known each other for years. It's a great book. But we have to start at the beginning. 3 a.m., that's nothing.
I know. Tam's the only person I talk to who gets up before I do.
So I want to start with the question that you heard put to the crowd before we came out here, which is, why this book? You wrote All Too Human in 1999. You got lots of different ideas, lots of different proposals, and I love the idea that you said, if it's not new, I don't want to do it.
Well, that was the whole thing. Since I wrote All Too Human, I had not written another book. As you said, I had thought about it many times. I actually started a book and put it aside because it really wasn't good enough. It wasn't. I was working on the chapter and said, no, I don't have the right angle here. But when this idea came to me, it was just the three words, the Situation Room. And my first question was, has it been done before? And it really hasn't. There has not been a popular history of the Situation Room, which was created by John F. Kennedy in 1961. And I thought, there was one book by a former staffer, it was a little bit more of a technical book, came out about 20-something years ago, but I thought when I heard the idea, it was a perfect way to tell the story of the presidents from Kennedy through Biden and examine the way they make decisions, the way they have dealt with crises. And once we got started, it was just a joy to work on.
Why hadn't it been done? It's in every movie. That is the heart of the movie, the greatest amount of drama.
I don't know exactly why. I mean, actually, I was talking to Fareed Zakaria, and he was very honest with me, with friends, and he read the book, and he thought it was great, he said. But he said, when I heard the idea, I was a little skeptical. Like, how can you write a book about a room? but he said, you figured out a way to do it. And really, the construct is, it came from one of the people we interviewed, General Doug Lute, who worked for both President George W. Bush and Obama. And he said, the real way to think about it is the three Ps, the place, the actual room, the Situation Room, a complex of rooms, the processes by which they made decisions in the room, and the people who work there. And using that as kind of the analytical guide to each chapter really helped as we were writing.
A quick question about the place. It comes about John F. Kennedy. A friend says to him, you really need a place to get all of your information. After the Bay of Pigs, he says, I really need a place to get all of my information. It's rudimentary in so many different ways. And it takes history itself. George Bush can't get Dick Cheney on the phone and says, fix it. Obama needs to have video conferencing with McRaven during the bin Laden raid. So things come about. Bill Clinton needs to do a deposition. Other things are going on. Why does the room almost have to be pushed into the future?
That's a very, very good question. And, you know, it's always been behind the private sector. There's no question about that. Government works a little more slowly. You know, one of the simple reasons is that it's very difficult to get presidents to agree to give up the space. You know, and I opened the Obama chapter, which is mostly about the takedown of Osama bin Laden, but I opened the Obama chapter with a conversation with Valerie Jarrett, who is a close advisor, really mentor to Barack Obama and Michelle Obama. And they were coming to her and the president at the first couple of years of the Obama administration saying, you know, we really want to renovate the West Wing and the Situation Room. It's a complete fire trap. I mean, it was. And it's antiquated, and the technology was not up to the 21st century. And they kept resisting and saying no and saying no. And finally, there was a meeting in the Situation Room where Valerie Jarrett said, listen, the first black president of the United States is not going to leave the Oval Office. There is no way. And they ended the conversation. The renovation, finally, there was one renovation under George W. Bush, in part because of the reason you said. The communications on 9/11 were revealed a problem. Remember that President Bush was in Sarasota, Florida, and Vice President Cheney went into that secret facility called the PEOC, the Emergency Operations Center, which is deep in the bowels of the White House. And they had a hard time communicating because no one had ever thought that the president would have to communicate with himself. You know, the president was supposed to be in the PEOC, and they had a renovation after that. And then the big renovation was completed just last August. And I had the good fortune to be able to go and tour it about 3 weeks before they revealed it to the world in August and September of last year. And I was completely blown away. Because when I worked for President Clinton, the room itself was not much to look at. It was a pretty unremarkable place, very low ceilings. I guess I can't make this joke here. I say that it looked like a conference room in the Poconos, but I don't want to. I don't want to insult anybody in Pennsylvania. But now it is like the movies. Now it is a suite of several rooms, the highest possible tech. The watch officers all have 3 screens in front of them, screens on every wall. You can do summits with 8 world leaders at a time, and it's finally made it into the 21st century.
And in fact, Bob Gates, the room is part of it, but there's it's like Harry Potter. You do with it what you will, each president. Because he says to you, if any problem is easy to solve, somebody at a lower level will solve it and take credit for it. So almost every decision the president makes is selecting the least bad option, which is a scary thing to walk into. And there's a balancing effect. It tells you something about the man. LBJ stayed too much. Nixon wouldn't come at all because of his paranoia. Like, getting the balance right is critical.
It's very difficult. You know, Kennedy didn't use it that much either, even though he had pushed to get it created after the Bay of Pigs. Although, as you say, it is true, it was actually proposed to him before the Bay of Pigs crisis, 2 or 3 weeks before the Bay of Pigs crisis, by one of the most fascinating men we came across in the research, a man named Godfrey McHugh. He was a Air Force general who spoke English with a French accent. He'd actually grown up in Paris, the son of an industrialist, and he's one of these people that just turns up everywhere. As a teenager, he had lunch at the White House with Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. He sailed on Harry Truman's yacht. He dated Jackie Kennedy before John F. Kennedy married her. And he was a close aide to Kennedy. And he had actually given Kennedy a paper before the Bay of Pigs that said, you need a situation room in the White House. And we think that's the first reference ever to that term. But Kennedy, of course, didn't do it until after the Bay of Pigs, where he was very angry with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the CIA because he didn't feel he was getting the information he needed. After it was created, though, he didn't use it all that much. He thought it was a pig pen, which at the time it was. And it was very, very much a smoke-filled room as well. Johnson, as you said, was there all the time. He actually moved his chair down, his favorite chair, down from the Oval Office because he wanted to be there so much. And not only was he there all the time, but he was constantly on the phone with the Situation Room all through the night. And we include both the transcripts in the book and the tapes in the audiobook of these phone calls that he's making, trying to get any scrap of information about what's happening in Vietnam. Johnson was also an information freak. He would have had 7 cell phones today. He had 72 phones at his ranch in Texas. He had phones in every room of the White House. But if you look at the idea that Kennedy wanted the Situation Room set up because he believed information is power, what you learn from Johnson's experience, he's trying to get every scrap of information, you learn that information isn't necessarily insight. Because all the data he was getting from Vietnam really wasn't going to tell him how to win that war. He was trapped. You're not going to, body counts aren't going to tell you anything. An advance in one part of the country is not going to tell you anything. Deep down, he knew that. But this was the only way he knew how to work, just to pick up the phone and try to get any scrap of information. Nixon reacted to LBJ. He never went to the Situation Room, very, very rarely. And for kind of one high-minded reason and one that was not so high-minded. The not so high-minded one, he was paranoid, and he didn't trust those who worked in the Situation Room. Remember, Nixon and Kissinger famously tapped the phones of many of their national security aides. The other reason came from, I interviewed Henry Kissinger before he died for this book as well, and what he talked about is he felt that Johnson, LBJ, succumbed to what he called the Situation Room syndrome, the idea that you could somehow control the room, the world, from this windowless, room in the basement of the White House, and you had to resist kind of that temptation. So, but you're right; every president has to work out their own balancing act.
The story of Carter is the story of ghosts. There's the People magazine version you've heard about. But there's also a second one. Let's start with the paranormal. Everybody's hearing about this right now. The idea that mind readers might be able to help. It sounds nuts, but when you read the chapter, not necessarily Jimmy Carter saying he thinks that he's seen something, but what some of the information that comes back, they might have been onto something.
It was an incredible story. I mean, this was the most fun story to report in the book. When we were doing the initial research, you know, we did all kinds of things. We visited the presidential libraries. I scoured the memoirs and diaries of all the president. This was all before we started doing our interviews. And I was going through Jimmy Carter's diaries looking for, you know, references to the Situation Room. And I came up upon one line, May 8, 1980, and they said he had a meeting in the Situation Room on parapsychology, and then something about longitude and latitude, et cetera. And, you know, I saw that one line and said, wow, there must be a story here. Nothing written about it anywhere, but we finally tracked down a man named Jake Stewart, who was a naval aide to Jimmy Carter. He's about 85 years old now. He was very hard to reach. We sent letters, we sent emails, we called. He resisted. Finally, he took one phone call and said, tell me a little bit more about what you're doing. And I talked about generally how we're doing a chapter on each president. I'd love to talk to you about President Carter. And it turned out to be one of those things, and Tam, you'll appreciate this as a reporter, where when you finally get there, it's just the most gratifying feeling in the world. We finally got him on a Zoom, and I said, you know, we came across this diary entry, May 8th, 1980, and as soon as I read it, he just lit up a huge smile on his face and said, oh, you found out about that. Well, I said, not exactly. What happened? and he then proceeded to tell us the story for the next hour, which is he had become the expert in the White House on something called Operation Grill Flame, which was an actual program in the 1970s and the 1980s funded with millions and millions of dollars, where the CIA and the DIA employed psychics. Literally, they employed psychics who would go into a dark room and close their eyes and get into a meditative state and do what they called remote viewing. Imagine things happening all around the world. Now, this is quite controversial, but the proponents of the program said it had about a 30 to 40% accuracy rate, which in intelligence is not that bad. It's really not. And there were some eerie coincidences they wrote about, including one woman who was sitting in a dark room a few weeks before this May 8th meeting, and she saw fire, a crash, and she started crying uncontrollably. That was the day that the helicopters went down in the desert in Iran. So this diary entry is 2 weeks later. It's May 8th, 1980, and Jimmy Carter is desperate. The helicopters have gone down. The hostages have been dispersed. He's beginning to lose to Ronald Reagan. The economy is flatlining. So he calls Jake Stewart in, gets a 45-minute briefing on the program, doesn't say a word. At the end of 45 minutes, he writes one word on a notepad and slips it across the table. You can guess what the word is. Hostages. Can you help? He asked. And so Jake Stewart spent the next couple of months putting the remote viewers to work. They say that they actually helped locate one of the hostages, a man named Richard Queen, who was suffering from multiple sclerosis, who actually was released early. But of course, the rest of the hostages were not released until after Ronald Reagan took the oath of office on January 20th, which was, you know, one more way for the Iranians to stick it to Jimmy Carter. They just were not going to allow it to happen on his watch.
I do have to say, on Nancy Reagan's behalf and her psychic advisor, they're somewhere going, mm-hmm. The other ghosts, often, so much of the personnel in this room, both famous names that you know and people behind the scenes, exists through administrations. There's often a bookend from one president to another. Jimmy Carter, in some ways, is a bookend to Barack Obama because the words Desert One means so much about why we got bin Laden and things went the way they did, even when things broke down.
No question about it. That was one of the most interesting things that came through in our research. how presidential administrations go to school on each other. And Desert One influenced an entire generation of national security professionals. One of, at the time of the Desert One, Robert Gates was a mid-ranking official in the CIA. He worked on this. And that haunted him for the rest of his career. And in fact, he turned out to be the most reluctant of President Obama's senior advisors to approve the rescue mission for Osama bin Laden. And he actually confessed to the president. He said, maybe my experience has colored me too much. Maybe it's made me too cautious. Obama said, no, it's exactly what I need. Admiral McRaven, who was the leader of the Navy SEAL mission, who devised the operation that took down Osama bin Laden, had studied Desert One at the War College. He had gone to school on it. He did 12,000 missions, and they knew exactly the mistakes that Carter made that they weren't going to make: communications, having extra helicopters. And sure enough, you all remember during the raid on the Abbottabad compound, one of the helicopters went down, had a complete hard landing. Everybody in the room, and can you imagine being in that room if you're an advisor to President Obama, and all of them knew the story of Jimmy Carter, and at that moment, they're thinking exactly the same thing. Oh my God, our presidency is crippled if this operation has fallen in the same way. McRaven didn't skip a beat. He had completely planned for it. There were two other helicopters not 30 miles away, and they were already in the air by the time the first one had made the hard landing, and the mission went off seamlessly without, even though they had lost a helicopter. It was incredible.
There's some presidents that you just don't think about them as much as you do others, but this book gives you an opportunity to know them in a different way. And one for me was George H.W. Bush in Tiananmen Square, where he's calling to the Situation Room and he wants information, and they think he wants what most presidents would want. And he goes, no, I need the street. Because he was almost an intelligence officer himself.
Because he knew essentially the ambassador to China.
Beijing that well. I need to know the street, because he rode his bike all over Beijing. It gave me a different sense of him.
He would often call down to the Situation Room. He said just on Saturdays and ask them to send up funny cables from his ambassadors. He said, that was such an interesting time, and it shows, as you pointed out at the beginning, the Situation Room was always a step behind the private sector, yet surprisingly, in technology. When Tiananmen Square happened, because of the issue you just raised, the Situation Room duty officers actually ran down the street. There was an old map store in Farragut North, which is about a block from the White House, and they actually ran to the map store and got a map of Beijing so they could answer the president's questions about what was happening in Tiananmen Square. Of course, now we'd all just pull out our phones.
It was fascinating to think about that level of detail, and I have to say, the chapter on the bin Laden raid, I was in a coffee shop, and I'm sure they thought there was something wrong. Even though I know how the story ends, I had to get up and just walk around, hearing the perspective.
So tense.
From the Situation Room.
This was months and months, obviously, of planning in the highest secrecy. Only a handful of people knew about it at first. They were bringing in one or two people along every couple of weeks, but it was very, very closely held up until the final moments. By the time the decision had to be made, it was in early May, they had a final meeting in the Situation Room, and they've done a whole another round of testing where the best the intelligence community can say is that it's maybe a 40% chance that it's bin Laden. Obama's made it a little higher. He said it's probably a 50% chance, but that's not great odds to risk your presidency on. So he polls the room, and he asks every principal what they would do. Gates was the most reluctant. He actually said, let's do a drone strike, but he then amended it when he went back to the Pentagon because two of his aides said, no, you can't be against this. Obama then did something that was I had never heard being done in the Situation Room before. You know, there's the table that has all the principals, the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, CIA, Director, National Security Advisor, but there's also chairs around the table for each person can generally bring in one aide. Obama not only polled the principals, he asked every plus one for their opinion as well, which is kind of an intimidating moment for a relatively junior staffer. Although, as one told me, listen, as my boss had already declared himself, I was just going to say what he said. And then Obama didn't say a word, made the decision the next morning. You might remember that he made the decision, they had the meeting on a Thursday, he made the decision on a Friday. The Saturday was the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And that was the famous Correspondents' Dinner where he eviscerated Donald Trump. I was at a table where I could see Donald Trump while the president was giving the speech, and that was kind of fun. but at our table was Bill Daley, who's the White House Chief of Staff, and Tom Donald is the National Security Advisor. My wife was sitting between the two of them. They weren't, and my wife is funny and she's pretty. They were not giving her the time of day. They were on their phones the whole time. Donald was popping up and down the whole night. He knew something was going on. At one point, Eric Stone Street from Modern Family, who was also at our table, that's the White House Correspondents' Dinner in a nutshell, by the way, was complaining very loudly about how his tour at the White House the next day had been canceled. Isn't that outrageous? And Bill Daley muttered something about, well, the plumbing's not working or something like that. And of course, they were all keeping the raid secret. And then the next day, they go in and they were all started to drift into the White House in the morning. And they finally, in the mid-afternoon, the helicopters were in the air. And they had set up the feed to see see what was happening. It was in a separate room, though. It was in a room off the main conference room. And Obama looked over and said, you know, why is everybody going over there? And he said, well, there's a live feed. Well, said, I'm going to go watch it, too, then. But what was interesting about that was Tom Donilon tried to get the feed moved into the actual situation room. And my favorite character in the book is a guy named Gary Bresnahan. He's the tech wizard that sets up all the secure communications. He's the one you alluded to, Tam. He served 7 presidents. And I call him a mix of MacGyver and Zelig. He's at every important event you could possibly imagine. He was on the plane to Tiananmen Square with Bryn Scowcroft setting up the secure communications then. He was at the hospital with Ronald Reagan setting up the secure communications with the White House there. He was on the special mission with Robert McFarlane, that failed crazy mission where he took a cake and a Bible to Iran as part of the Iran-Contra scandal. He was actually the videographer for Bill Clinton's grand jury testimony because he was the one who had set up the secure communications. And he tells the story about he was there for the practice sessions. It was just Clinton and his lawyers and Gary Bresnahan, who's everywhere. They were doing the practice, and after about an hour, they took a break, and Clinton turns to him and says, so how am I doing? And Gary, I have no idea how you're doing. I'm just the videographer. But that day, he told a little bit of a white lie because Tom Donilon asked him to move the communications into the main conference room, and he said he couldn't do it. He probably could have done it, but he was afraid that if he made any kind of adjustment, the communications line would go down. And it's a good thing that he didn't move because it created the most iconic photo we've ever seen in the Situation Room. And it was also a good thing for Gary Bresnahan because everybody had gone into the room. He was just outside, so he got the first fist bump from President Obama after they took down Bin Laden.
My favorite Gary Bresnahan story is, as you might imagine, during the time of the Bin Laden raid, he's not home very much. And his girlfriend is like, he's cheating on me. He's got to be cheating on me. And then 2 weeks later, you know, he comes home, the raid has happened, and he just says, you know, it was a good night for America. And she's like, yeah. And then the next morning she goes, good night for America, my ass.
That's right.
So Gary is a character.
Not only that, there's one more story like that. Mike Leiter, who was the person who did the final red team testing, intelligence testing of the plan, actually was getting married that Saturday night. So he went through with the ceremony, but he put off his honeymoon. His wife swears she knew. He swears he didn't tell her. Who knows? I don't know.
He married the right person. Yes. She was that understanding because he was distracted. Now we're going to take a turn and talk about Trump. And I say that taking a turn specifically because...
just made
let's get there first. The bin Laden raid. One of the things that's fascinating about the chapter is the degree to which secrecy was paramount. There are years of meetings in which no paper comes out, in which it's limited people. They take extra precautions because there's no way this can get back to Pakistan. Donald Trump comes in. Very rarely does he go to the Situation Room when there are meetings. You limit the number of people because you don't know what's getting taken out. When Donald Trump is doing it, they're the people in the room. There's an overflow room. There's the video feed of all of these secrets. George, this chapter is shocking. I don't know what was more shocking, that or the thing he wanted most from the Situation Room was them to collect the chyrons from Fox News.
No, it's incredible. No, I mean, one of the things that I learned as I was researching and writing this book is there was actually a great line of continuity among all of the Situation Rooms, from Kennedy through Biden, Republican and Democrat. They all learned from each other. Republicans and Democrats all agreed that Brent Scowcroft, who was George H.W. Bush's National Security Advisor, was kind of the gold standard of National Security Advisors. Jake Sullivan, who is President Biden's National Security Advisor, considers him a role model and mentor to him. And the administrations all learned from each other. Some people served in both Republican and Democratic, like Robert Gates. The real outlier was the Trump administration. There was just nothing normal about it. No, and serious. I mean, the national security professionals will say this as well. And you know, the theme that I came up with for that chapter was that the president was the crisis to be managed, which is the way the Situation Room actually had to deal with him through those years. I mean, you talked about, you know, the overflow rooms. Tom Bossert, who was his first Homeland Security advisor, the president was always complaining about leaking. He tells the story about one highly confidential meeting in the Situation Room. As soon as they walk out, he's walking out with the president, and the president picks up his phone and calls a reporter. And, you know, he's the leaker in chief. And, you know, Bossert admonished him about it, but he has this, what he says is that, you know, the reason Trump gets so angry is he believes everybody else is like he is. He didn't have any respect for the rules. We've all seen that now with the indictment over the classified information during the whole Ukraine scandal, the first impeachment. The entire government, the people, he did appoint some good people, but they were all working to give aid to Ukraine, and the president was upending it. And, you know, the real takeaway I got from the chapter is that the people who served in the most sensitive, high-level national security positions most closely with Donald Trump are the ones who have the most damning indictments of his competence and his character, whether it's General Mattis or General Kelly or Rex Tillerson or John Bolton or Mark Esper, who also served as Secretary of Defense. And they're the ones who give out the most chilling warnings of what it'll be like if he wins another term and it goes in basically unbound.
Well, I want to stay on that because you actually open the book with a desk officer named Mike Stiegler and his going to work on January 6th and feeling like something's not right and what the next 24 hours would be like when he's there. And he says this, "I think we would have probably seen, if the election certification hadn't gone through, I think we would have probably seen an institution crack, just crumble. I think a lot of us would have just walked out." And when you read this book and you realize how tied these people are to the Situation Room, that they serve the presidency, not the man, that is an incredible statement. And I couldn't help but think, in a second Trump term, what happens to that room if Johnny McEntee and his loyalty tests get a hold of it?
It's a very, very good question. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see who would come to work for a second Trump administration, who would get confirmed by the Senate. The president's, you know, former president, is saying in plain sight what he would do if he were elected. And forget about the policy. He's saying every single day, "I'm going to pardon the he calls the January 6th hostages. I'm going to seek retribution." You know, and we know that the president didn't go to the Situation Room that often because he believed it was the home of the deep state, the so-called deep state that was working against him. You know, I interviewed more than 100 people for this book, including several dozen of these duty officers, who are the best of the best in the United States government? People like Mike Stiegler, intelligence analyst, who was serving on January 6th, just trying to hold things together when they thought the vice president was about to be murdered on Capitol Hill, and the president was up in his study sending out a tweet attacking him. And these people come from every branch of the government, from the CIA, the DIA, NSA, defense and state, homeland security, all branches of the military. They are rigorously apolitical. They are there, as you said, to serve the presidency, not the president. They do their jobs under the most pressurized possible circumstances every single day on the front lines, the nerve center of the White House, serving their country. And what I learned is that the deep state is packed with patriots. It's people like that who are holding this government together. And Mike Stiegler added one more story when he was talking about January 6th. He was so shattered by what happened, but he was at least proud that they had done their job that day in holding the government together. And he, for the next three January 6th, he and several of his colleagues from the Situation Room would gather at the Lincoln Memorial each January 6th and raise a toast to the idea that the Republic still stood. I spoke with him just this week, and he had been quite reluctant to do an interview at first and ghosted me for months at a time. But he finally agreed to do it, and he sent me a text after our last interview, which really gratified me, because he said since he spoke out, he's heard from dozens of his colleagues in the government as well who served through these times as well, and they reached out to him and said how hearing the stories told has helped them process what happened. They're still committed to doing their job, and there will always be people committed to doing their jobs in the right way, but President Trump has made no secret that he's looking to smash that if he gets back in rather than bolster it.
I actually think you should put that on bags and T-shirts. The deep state is full of patriots. It's a beautiful line, and it struck me when I read it. And I want to talk, you say the book, The Situation Room, it is the place, the process, the people. And of the three, the people make you proud to be an American.
Absolutely. They inspired me.
A Reagan official says this he says, a good Situation Room officer must be focused, organized, intelligent, judicious, apolitical, a critical thinker, and cool under pressure. I could go the length and breadth of the land and not find 20 people who have the capacity by virtue of their training. And if there's one story in the book that tells you who these people are, explain to them the dead list.
9/11. Probably the most chaotic day, not maybe for many of us as well, but in the Situation Room, it was beyond that. They saw the first plane go in, and this will sound strange, but it's true. When the first plane went in, they weren't that bothered. You know, they say, you know, planes go into buildings all the time. Not the World Trade Center, but one of the duty officers I spoke with, Rob Hargis, tells the story of being on the phone with Deb Loewer, who was the Situation Room director, but she was in Sarasota, Florida with President Bush that day, and he was actually on the phone with her when the second plane went into the tower. And he tells the story of watching it and thinking it was a replay of the first plane going into the tower, and then he saw the line, the Chyron, at the bottom of the screen live. And his immediate reaction was, America is under attack. He said those words to Deb Loewer, who said them to Andy Card, who whispered them in the ear of President Bush that day. But that was the beginning of the day. What was happening when the attack first took place is you had Situation Room duty officers who weren't even working that day rushed to the White House, including a guy named Ed Podinsky, a naval officer, who was in a parent-teacher conference. And just like the firefighters ran to the Trade Center towers, these guys all ran to the White House. And remember, in those early minutes and hours, the White House was a target. And in fact, those officers were told not once, not twice, but three times to evacuate, to leave the Situation Room. Every single time, they looked up and said, no, we're staying. So finally, the director handed out a series of 3x5 cards and said, ask them all to write their name and social security number on the cards so they could take the cards out of the room and have what they called a kill list in case the White House actually was attacked by the planes. These people were so valiant on that day, and the Ed Podinsky story is particularly poignant. He's a naval officer, and he had just come from working in the Pentagon Operations Center. He lost 8 friends on 9/11, and yet he worked for the next, nonstop for the next several months. And as he was going to funerals, including for his best friend, every week for these fellow officers who died on 9/11, it turns out, and this is one of those bookends that you get with people who work in government for a career, it turns out that he was actually serving on the aircraft carrier in 2011 when they brought Osama bin Laden's body for the burial at sea, and he stood guard for that, and he was able to talk to his friends and honor the memory of the friends that he lost on that day and by getting the closure and believing that justice had finally been done.
The last president in the book is Joe Biden, and you talk about the disaster and trying to withdraw from Afghanistan, and you include some of your own interview with him, and you really press him, and he said, this was essentially the military intelligence I got. Speaking of bookends, JFK, and setting up the room, says to Ben Bradley, "My first advice I'm going to give my successor is to watch the generals and avoid feeling that just because they were military men, their opinions on military matters were worth a damn." And I thought about Joe Biden.
It's the story of Joe Biden. Joe Biden famously, and he will end up having spent more time in the Situation Room than any other president, because he not only visited there as a senator, but 8 years as vice president, at least 4, and he spent hours and hours in the room right now. But he was the one in the Obama administration who was constantly pushing back against the generals on Obama's behalf, pushing for a withdrawal of Afghanistan. One of the things he said in the interview with me was that there was never going to be a good time to leave. They clearly could have done the planning better, and they did not anticipate the Afghan army collapsing as quickly as it did. But he had always been pushing for a withdrawal, going back to 2011, 2012.
You wondered if he should have listened to the military men more, or if deep down inside he just listened to himself, he wanted out.
Well, he definitely wanted out. I mean, I think he's right about having to get out. It had become an absolute stalemate, but there's no question they could have done a better job of the security before getting out.
You talked about the relationship between him and Obama, and in fact, during the bin Laden raid, as they're going around the room, people realized later they were playing parts, because everybody wants to say what the boss wants to hear. And Joe Biden is the one raising all the concerns. And it was meant to give everybody else in the room cover, that it was okay to say, "I see a problem." And you realize how well they function together. And it made me wonder about Joe Biden's vice president, Kamala Harris. She's mentioned a couple of times. But when you ask him, "Who's your backstop?" Jake Sullivan sort of goes, I felt like he was just trying to back out of the room.
Well, no, Biden played devil's advocate for Obama. And he said, if it doesn't happen organically, then it doesn't happen. I don't believe Kamala Harris plays that role, certainly not on national security issues with President Biden. It's difficult because he's had so much more experience than she has. If anybody plays that role in the Biden administration, Jake Sullivan said it's probably him. But the job of national security advisor is a difficult one, because you're the president's, generally the president's closest confidant on these issues, but you also have to be an honest broker among all of the principals at the table. And these processes, and it's clear from studying all the presidents, they work best when you do have a full airing of views, where people are not afraid to speak truth to power, and where presidents do have a range of opinion from which they can decide. The Osama bin Laden raid is just one example. By the time a decision gets to the Situation Room, if it reaches that level of the president, it's almost by definition close to an impossible decision. It means you don't really have a great option. You're picking among least worst options. So much of the work of the Situation Room every single day is actually having meetings of deputies who solve many of those problems before they reach that level. It's their job to kind of grind through issues. And if they can reach a consensus, it generally doesn't reach the president. If it reaches all the way to the top, it's the toughest of the tough.
Biden is at his age. It's something to think about that should he win a second term, his vice president could step into those shoes. Did you get a sense of what Kamala Harris would be like, the first female president running the Situation Room?
Not really. I chose two episodes to talk about in the Biden chapter, the withdrawal from Afghanistan and the lead up to the war in Ukraine. One of the things that, you know, with books, unfortunately, I had to turn in this manuscript last September, so it was all before the Yom Kippur War. We don't have anything on that in there, although the president has spent hours and hours in the Situation Room recently. She wasn't a big player, certainly in the Afghanistan experience, a little bit more on Ukraine. She had one important meeting at the Munich Security Conference. But she, like President Biden, though, I do think that she's been included in all the decisions as vice president. I didn't hear a lot about her voice.
And again, the room is about the people as well that you have around the principal. I'm going to ask him a couple of news questions. Get ready, because we'll also take questions from the crowd. Really quickly, Eric Schmidt, the tech giant, says to you, essentially, the Situation Room is halfway stupid. The computer should be doing this. That they should look for the patterns and the human should do the reasoning. Multiple times in the book, somebody says, I just had a feeling. And computers can't just have a feeling.
No,
he right? We should let a computer do half of it?
He makes it, I think he is right, but what you do, there's no question that computers now and artificial intelligence can, you know, they can sift through literally billions of bits of information every hour. So you don't need people now to do pattern recognition to pick out a new bit of information that comes out in any moment. But you do need the people to be guiding the computers, to be asking the right questions of the computers, to be putting their reasoning to the data that is coming out. And that's why in some ways the people are still irreplaceable. Their just job is going to change. They're going to be more like editors than researchers going through it. But the actual collection of information, there's no question that it can be done better by computers now.
A couple of quick news questions. We have debates on the books. They're going to happen. What happens for each campaign if they have a bad debate? If Biden has a bad night, if Trump has a bad night, what are the stakes?
Huge. And we'll see. I think the first debate will definitely happen. I'm pretty sure the second debate will happen, but it's hard to know depending on how the first one goes. And you know, I'll remember, the Chris Wallace debate 4 years ago was literally the worst presidential debate ever. I think that the rules that President Biden proposed, not having an audience, having it simply in a studio, having mics that cut off when it's not your time, could help prevent that. But you also have the problem of, and you know, this will fall, a lot of this will fall on the moderators and on the candidates. You know, I would never do a live interview with President Trump now, because you know, I'm trying to say this is just not a partisan comment, but it's a factual comment. You know, 40 to 60% of what he says simply isn't true. And so you always have this problem of, if it's live, it's not fair to our viewers to simply, you know, give them misinformation in that way. You have the same problem going on in the debate. I do think that part of the reason that President Biden did what he did is that to have an early debate, that in case something goes wrong, you have time to recover. But look at in this election, and you guys are, you know, you're the epicenter of the presidential election. Everybody here in Pennsylvania, it is going to be decided by probably 500,000 people in five states. I mean, you have so much of the country that is locked in on one side or the other. There's only a handful of states that are really in play, and you know, I guess it's a good thing. I know it's a good thing for WPVI to have all this attention here, but you all are going to be saturated with it. In many parts of the country, it's almost not going to be happening. But your votes are going to be very, very critical here: Wisconsin, Michigan, maybe Georgia, Nevada, and Arizona. And that's kind of it. And it's such a change from, you know, when I worked in the first Clinton campaign, we had a target map of 19 states that were considered battlegrounds. Now it's down to 6 at most. Some people say 3. I mean, it's the politics, the way that people have just become locked into their positions has become so profound that the something so hugely consequential is being fought in a smaller and smaller area.
Another big piece of news we had today is a story that actually happened 3 years ago, but is now percolating, that after the election, an upside-down flag, a symbol of distress, flying outside of Judge Samuel Alito's home. First, I wanted to hear your reaction to it. As somebody both who's been a journalist and worked within a government, what was your reaction to that story? And you might have to explain why this is disturbing.
In January of 2021, if you were flying an upside-down flag, that meant stop the steal. It's exactly what it meant, sign of distress. So that was being flown on Justice Alito's lawn in January of 2021. He blames his wife. I found out about this. I was actually in Washington, D.C. last night doing an event like this, so I didn't find out about it until after I got off the stage. I immediately called my executive producer and started to plot out what we would be doing on it this morning on GMA, even though I wasn't going to be there because I was on my way here. Because I think this is one of those things that, you know, I've been talking a lot about this recently. I think this is the most abnormal presidential campaign in history in many, many ways. And I think we've gotten numbed to things that should shock us beyond, out of our skin. And this is one of them. Right now we have 2 Supreme Court justices deciding cases dealing with the 2020 election, deciding whether or not President Trump is going to be tried for being the only president in American history to try to overturn an election. And one of them, Ginni Thomas, was working on the insurrection. And now, at absolute best, Justice Alito's wife was putting up a signal that meant exactly the same thing. I'm sorry, I don't think that's an excuse. I can guarantee you that if my wife did an upside-down flag on our lawn, I would be fired by ABC News pretty quickly. Bernie says yes, too. Yes. It's outrageous that they're allowed to decide these cases, and especially when you look at the way the Supreme Court has been dealing with these cases, and, you know, slow walking the January 6th case so that the trial is almost certainly not going to happen before the election. And now it also puts a new light on the kind of questions that Justice Alito was asking during the oral arguments for this case, where he maybe infamously suggested in his questioning that the threat of prosecution of a president who tried to overturn an election was actually more troubling than what actually happened on January 6th, 4 years ago. Listen, I believe it is simply outrageous. There have been some calls to recuse. That's not going to happen. The Supreme Court is one of those places where they police themselves. They can do whatever they want. And that's what they're doing.
Working in a few questions, I mean, you've talked about how hard it is to not become numb, that you're trying to fight against that, to wake people up. And somebody says, assuming the nation is the most divided now, when were we the most bipartisan? Can we remember a time? Is there something in it to inspire us now?
Yeah, we had a bipartisan consensus. You know, there were always differences on issues, but I think we had a fairly bipartisan consensus through the 50s and starting into the 60s. It kind of fell apart during Vietnam and Watergate. We came together for a while after 9/11. But since then, you know, the polarization has gotten worse every single year. And now it's you know, intensified by the problems of the way people get information. Mm-hmm. Right now, everybody's simply getting siloed information where they're simply getting information that reinforces what they already believe. And, you know, that poses a challenge to us as journalists because, you know, I know, for example, that often if I'm simply fact-checking someone, that's going to be perceived by X percent of the audience as partisan, even if it's simply, you know, trying to be factual and accurate. And, you know, it gets to the point where, I mean, think about this. You have, the number shifts a little bit, but you now have at least 60 to 70% of the Republican Party who've absorbed the idea that the 2020 election was stolen. I've had a series of Republican politicians who are quite critical of the actions after January 6th, who are now endorsing President Trump and refusing to say that the election was fair in 2020, refusing to pledge that they will accept the results of the election in 2024. This is unlike anything we've ever seen in our history, yet it's become almost normalized.
Someone wants to know the level of clearance you need to get into the Situation Room.
Hi. Well, it's interesting now, you know, I was able to go there last week to do the first interview, broadcast interview inside the Situation Room, and, you know, there's screens everywhere, but they have a kill switch where the minute someone without the clearance walks in to the room, the screens are usually just covered with information. They immediately go blank when somebody without a clearance walks into the room. The people who work there need the minimum top secret, and then depending on the kind of information they're dealing with, they can go into the most highly compartmentalized, they call it code word classifications, that is, you know, for very small groups of people. But they do take visitors in just to see it for a couple minutes.
This is a quick one. The most decisive president in the Situation Room, the least decisive?
Well, that's a good question. In some ways, George H.W. Bush was both, and they both served him. He was incredibly decisive and stood up to the military in the first Iraq war when they were pushing back against him and saying, you know, we're going to need far more than you're saying, and he just ordered them to go do it. He was more patient and less decisive in the wake of all the revolutions sweeping across Eastern Europe in the fall of the Berlin Wall, but that turned out to be the right thing to do. I mean, Bob Gates talks about this, about how skillfully Bush and Scowcroft managed that those revolutions that were sweeping. It was basically the art of doing nothing and just allowing it to happen.
And we're going to end on a fun one. I'm binging The West Wing again and loving it. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much is, like, the real West Wing?
They talk much faster and walk much faster and, for the most part, are better looking. but, you know, no, it's an incredibly realistic... I think it's as realistic as television can be for a show like that. Things are compressed. It was all based on real situations. And in fact, I had the chance, I knew Aaron Sorkin a little bit, and I had the chance, they had asked me to work on the show. I said no to that, but when I first came to ABC, I did some stories about it. They invited me to a table read, and he said, George, you're the original Slim Shady. He said, there's a little bit of you in all of these characters. And they had a couple of plot lines based on my life, including one where I was getting sued in the 1990s by this harassing organization called Judicial Watch, which was, you know, saying that I was part of a conspiracy with Hillary Clinton and James Carville. I hadn't even spoken with Hillary in like 4 years. The suit was dismissed several times. But finally, after the fourth time on appeal, they kept bringing the suit. I got so fed up at one of the depositions that I simply just turned the tables on the guy who was deposing me and just kept asking questions back in the most petulant possible manner, and that became an episode of The West Wing several years later.
Well, they said we have time for one more, so this is the real last one, and it's a sweet one. I'll tell you the end before the question. Thank you for your honesty and your integrity and your journalism.
Thank you.
And What is your favorite memory of working in the White House? You guys ask good questions.
You do ask good questions. I have a couple that stand. I'm just sort of free associating what instantly went through my mind when you asked the question. The first thing that popped into my head was an amazing moment. It's sad to think of now, but it was in 1993 when Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin shook hands on the White House lawn. And it seemed like that moment might be bringing in a new era of peace. And of course, it wasn't to be. So that's a bittersweet memory. I also, and I was thinking of this, another bittersweet memory. Just the other day, a man named Christopher Edley, who I first worked with in the Dukakis campaign, and then he's a law dean and civil rights expert. He just passed away this week, and we worked together on a program to pretty much save affirmative action. It was called Men Don't End Affirmative Action. And the day that the President Clinton gave the speech announcing that series of policies, which ended up preserving, I think, opportunity and education for helping preserve it for about 20 years, was a proud day in the White House as well.
These are wonderful memories. I have to ask you, they're asking that you wait a little bit. We're going to give George a minute to get out and get to his car. He's got an early morning flight to Chicago tomorrow, so he's got to get out of the room. And just on a personal note, I want to thank you for the book, George. In these times, it's easy to be so disheartened and numb, as you point out. But this book reminds us that great Americans are around us all the time and have done amazing things on our behalf, even though we don't even know their names. So we have that within us, and if we could remember that and see it in each other, where might we be? So thank
you. Inspiring. Thank you. Thank you for the thoughtful interview. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.